she could teach any sort of art and craft that anybody could think of. And Ruth wanted to put her to work teaching our own help different arts and crafts. We put her to work in the old building that was in front of Warner Park. And she started off with clay and just little common things. And our people were the only ones who went there. But if it was copper tooling or woodwork, if it was painting, if it was sculpturing, if it was ceramics, Miss Daly knew how to do it. And we let our own people go in there, and whichever one they adapted themselves to, that they felt like they could make a success with back in their community center, we let them take that. But they got so interested, till most every community center person that we had became good in three or four different arts. And then after we had trained our people, we decided to open that to the public, and we advertised that for a certain fee, men or women, either one, could come out and they could take a painting, they could take brass tooling, they could take ceramics, they could take whatever they took, whatever they wanted to take. And one of the men that I can think of that joined up in it was an architect by the name of Rufus Hull that works with Ted Franklin today. But I don't take any credit for this. But we began to get women from Rome and Cleveland and Signal Mountain and Lookout Mountain interested in ceramics. And some of them got real good in it. And ever since we started that thing, there's been a surge in ceramics all over this area. It wasn't up to me. I didn't do it. But Ruth Hale talked me into hiring Miss Daly. And she did it, and I think, without any boasting at all, that Miss Daly was responsible for this huge amount of interest that there is today in the arts and crafts in Chattanooga. Now, we on the City Commission knew that we were getting along good. Now, we all wanted something more in the way of improvements in the core city. But improvements in the core city came slow. But some of the things that we were talking about years ago are becoming realities in downtown today. And it shows through this, throughout this country, that people are more ready to come back to town than ever before. And if Chattanooga will meet its obligation to do what we need to do in downtown, and as you know, John, that I'm a consultant for the downtown committee. Now, my whole soul is tied up in trying to do something in downtown that will make Chattanooga become the city it ought to be. And I think that it will happen. Now, in the election of 63, Kelly beat Rudy O'Judd.
Ralph Kelly.
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you how it happened. When we got ready to start the interstate system in Chattanooga, they called Rudy O'Judd, the city attorney, and Pat Wilcox, who was a commissioner of public works. And wherever Rudy went, I went. And I went with him. And they had the four major cities in Tennessee and said, men, we've got the money, but we can supply the men to appraise this property and to get it bought or under condemnation.
That's the property for the freeway.
For the freeway.
Mm-hmm. And the connecting links.
That's right. And on the way back, Ojotti says, men, we're going to get our part of that money first. We're going to get down Chattanooga first. We went to one firm and asked them if they would do the appraisal to be done on it. Then we went to Pat St. Charles.
A local real estate man.
A local real estate man. And he said he would take it. He didn't want it. He said, I'll take it. Now, we had one man. Now, in Nashville and in Memphis, they gave it to 10 or 12 or 15 different firms. And there wasn't anybody that they could go to. There wasn't anybody in charge. But Rudy knew when money was to be available for interstate. And he'd call Pat St. Charles in, and we had all the plans. And Pat had all the plans. He'd say, Pat, between this date and this date, I want you to have every piece of property from this point right here to right here, either bought or in court, being condemned. And Pat would say, well, Mr. Mayor, I just came to get it done. He says, how late do you work at night? He said, well, Mr. Mayor, I go home. And he said, it won't hurt you to work at night on this job. Do you ever work on Saturday? Does the Irishman ever work on Sunday? I want this in, and I want it completed. So when they got that money to let over there, we've got something that's ready to go. And that was the way that Pat got driven. From the time he took that job till it was over. And in these other two cities, Nashville and Memphis, and I don't know the facts about Knoxville, they had 15 or 16 or 17 different real estate men. That and doing this, this and doing that, and that and doing that, but they didn't have anybody responsible. And Chattanooga was getting its interstate built. And Memphis still hadn't got all of theirs. They aren't.
Even to this day.
That's right.
But Chattanooga was the first in the state, wasn't it?
That's right. But that was the big thing that Ralph Kelly beat.
Well, and what was the big thing? I mean, you have St. Charles doing this as a single person. Was Mayor Ojotti then criticized for not spreading it out among other people?
Well, not that, but they all thought that Pat St. Charles was getting rich off of
it,
and that everybody at the city hall was, well, not everybody, but that people were profiting off of it.
I see. Mm-hmm.
But we actually did it at least half as cheap and twice as quick.
As the other cities.
Rudy wouldn't let a man stop.
Mm-hmm. Now, he was a driver.
He was a driver. And he wouldn't make it come.
And because of the suspicions and the charges and countercharges in that time of campaign, it's your feeling that's largely helped defeat Rudy Ojotti.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, there was one other factor in it. And they were building the Homer Wheeler Homes or... Wheeler Homes, a housing project for colored out in Alton Park.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some low land out there. And during that campaign, there was a lot of rain and a lot of this, that, and the other. And Rudy was accused of building that in a mud hole. And Rudy Ojotti had asked five black men of good repute in Chattanooga for them to go select a site as to where that Emma Wheeler home should be built. And that is the site they selected. But Rudy never said anything.
And then...
That was one of the other things.
Did that sort of help him lose the black vote, would you say?
No. It helped him just...
Just added to the feeling that he'd been ineffectual or he had done things that he shouldn't do. Also, my recollection, George, is at that particular time, Ralph Kelly's view on civil rights, which was a very hot national issue at the time and sort of spilled into everything else, was more to the right than Rudy's position was.
Well, Rudy never backed away from it.
That's what I mean, and my recollection is I think Pat had sort of played a little more to the right wing and to the Western boys' attitude in the state, which came as something of a surprise, if you remember, because Ralph had been sort of a protege of Estes Kefauver when he was a youngster.
That's right.
And I think people were a little surprised at some of the stands he took or seemed to be taking at that time, although, of course, that was a political game, as you know, all over the South, because subsequently Ralph became a very, very able, even-handed mayor.
Well, now, one thing about...
I think Rudy got hurt on all those issues.
Yes.
Well, as a matter of historical fact, there's ample evidence that he had been a real builder in this town.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the mistakes, the other big mistake that was ever made here in Chattanooga was after Kelly was elected mayor, and we had a bill that had already been approved by every court in the land but the Supreme Court of the state on annexation. We wanted to take in the area up at around Hickson, which included DuPont and Dixie Mercerized. And we had the thing won, and the change in mayorship, Kelly and Bender, who had been reelected after we put him in past place, and Bookie Turner voted against. They voted for withdrawing that bill from court.
Mm-hmm.
And Dean Peterson and I were strong for keeping it. We wanted that annexation. But that they killed it. And then from then on, every annexation that came up, people contested it, cost themselves, the city, and everybody else money, thinking that they would be lucky enough to come out with the same result as DuPont and the others did.
Mm-hmm.
But now that hurt Chattanooga. It has made every annexation since objected to by the people in the area, thinking that, well, DuPont and them are big guys. They got out of it. Let's fight it, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's cost us all money. But I sort of played a trick on Ralph Kelly, and I hope he'll hear this. I had a lot of influence with the Tennessee Municipal League. Rudy had served as president. I'd served as president. I called Herb Bingham. And I said, Herb, you know we got a new mayor in Chattanooga? He said, yeah, Ralph Kelly beat the best mayor in the state. I said, I want you to put Ralph Kelly on the board of directors.
On the board of what?
The board of directors, mm-hmm, of the Tennessee Municipal League.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm on that board, and I'll see that he gets over there every time. And at every board meeting, have somebody on that board get up and tell how well they're getting along with their annexation program. And Ralph kept hearing that time after time after time. And if you will recall, in his last year or his last few months in office, he was the strongest man on annexation that we'd ever had. He was even stronger than old Johnny for annexation.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things that Rudy was wise enough to do. Rudy would know approximately what it would cost to service this particular area.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd know about how long it would take to do it. Then in your first year in office, your first year in your new term, start that annexation and borrow that money. You're getting it for 4 and 4.5%. And we can put it back in the bank for 6 or 6.5%. And by the time the next election's round, all that sewer would be underground and the streets would be paved and they'd have water. Now, one time...
And in addition, had a little profit in the bank from the interest.
That's right.
Like the old-time country politician, pave the roads as soon as you get elected, so the one you run the next time, you can point to the road.
Well, that's what we were doing. Mm-hmm. We were telling those people what we were...
Have that visible proof.
And, In one of our elections, in the last election that Rudy won, I won with him. But he and I carried every precinct in the city of Chattanooga, including every precinct that had been annexed. Mm-hmm. That had never been done before.
Mm-hmm.
Two men carried every precinct. And that's the way we did it.
I would make this point, George, since I was a newspaper man, we were doing that too. That was done without a machine. There was no machine.
No,
there was no such thing as an Ojade or McIntosh machine.
No.
It was done without even being associated with anybody else's machine. There was no machine politics in Chattanooga at that time. And by then, even the so-called black wards and the bedding areas had all been cleaned up.
Well,
and radio and television were back into service where things are a little more open. And I would dare say that you both won it because you were both very popular.
Well,
I don't see any other reason.
Now,
which you were popular for doing the kind of things that people want done.
Well, the other members of the commission cooperated on it, too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ever like to say I'd rather say we. But that's the way the thing happened. Now, I want to tell you a little story here. Our recreation department in the summertime used some of the Department of Education's school grounds for playgrounds. And a lady was elected president of the PTA up on the ridge. And when somebody gets elected president of something like that, they want to get something done. So this nice lady called me up to the ridge. This lady called me up on the ridge and met her at the school, and she said, "Now, Mr. Magneter, we want to do this, we want to do that." And I said, "Well, now, I have an agreement with Superintendent Durthig that where we use his school grounds and we need to make any improvements, that he will agree to them and pay for half of them." She said, "Well, that suits me. I know Mr. Durthig could do that." And in 2 or 3 days, she called me and she said, "George, I can't get to talk to Mr. Durthig."
That's Alan Durthig.
Yeah, no.
Oh, the
Lawrence, Lawrence.
Lawrence Durthig. That's right.
Great.
Yeah.
Schoolman.
Well, he later became U.S. Commissioner of Education.
That's right. And, she said, "Do you think you could make me an appointment with the superintendent?" And back then, John, it wasn't smartness on my part, or it could have been. Anybody that was important to me, I knew their secretary. Well, I said, "I can get you an appointment, Mr. Durthig." And I called up and I asked for Ms. Lewis. She said, "Oh, that's you, Commissioner?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I want to make an appointment with Miss So-and-so to see Superintendent Durthig." She said, "Well, I've got his calendar right here. Just she can come next Thursday if she wants to. It's such and such a time." And I called and told her. And she went down there. Now, I'd forgotten about it. And on this Thursday afternoon, late, the telephone rang, and she was on the phone. She said, "George, I'm so mad, I'm about to bust." I said, "Why?" She said, "I just now realized that Mr. Derthick told me no."
Good story.
You know, if you ever wrote, Derthick was a wonderful man.
Yes, oh yes.
But if you ever wanted to get him on the phone, because he couldn't write a short letter, he always wrote a long letter.
True academic.
I've forgotten, John, I get so excited about this thing that during...
This is a time of reflection and anecdotes, George.
You must remember that during my last term in office, that the city commission gave me the money, Kelly and others, to remodel the auditorium. The city commission gave me the money with which to remodel the auditorium. And we did a beautiful job with it. And at the same time, they gave me permission to lease from ABC the Tivoli Theater, which the city has recently bought. And when I left the city commission, made me a lifetime honorary member of that auditorium board. Now, here is one of the most touching things that ever happened to me. I was sitting in my office one afternoon, and an old Negro lady came in. And it was sort of late in the summertime. She says, "Commissioner McIntyre, I'm so-and-so. And I live with my daughter and my son-in-law. They both work, but they've got a little girl, 5 years old and 1 7. And said, I take care of the children. And we live right across the street from this real nice playground. And there isn't another white family living anywhere within this area." And said, "My little granddaughters come to me and say, Grandma, why can't we go over and play?" And she said to me, says, "Why can't?" I said, "Well, you just give me a day or two." I knew some of the members of the Q Club Klan, and I called one of the victims on a Friday afternoon. I said, "I want to come out and see you three fellas Saturday morning." They said, "Come on." I went out there and told them. I said, "Now, we've got this facility where there isn't a white person living within a mile. All the white children that come to there have to come from some other place." And I told them this story about that I'd been told
by the grandmother.
And I said, "What would you men do?" They said, "George, go out and drive around for 30 minutes. Come back." Came back and it's all looking down at the floor, and they said, "Let them play." So I gave it to them.
And that's when the law was discriminatory, but
that's
you
right.
Just brush it aside and do it.
That's right.
And of course, what you had in mind was you didn't want them coming down there making any trouble for those kids.
That's right. Now, back a little earlier in the Kefauver and Couch days, Judge Couch always thought Estes ought to be in the office every time he called. But they'd call and sometimes they'd say, "Well now, Judge Couch, congressman's over in Chicago speaking tonight. New York. You know, he was a much sought-after speaker.
Oh, yeah, very active
in all
those things.
He was a great speaker, but...
Well, he was on several popular issues there, and if you remember,
right.
He was very active in world government right after World War II, which got him a lot of speaking.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you something about that in a minute. And Mr. Wiley just didn't like it. And he was thinking about running Frank Darwin against Estes Keepoff for Congress. And Frank Darwin was a very popular criminal judge, popular man, University of Virginia graduate, and officiated football and everything, a clean fella.
Mm-hmm.
And a boy by the name of Virgil Perkins, Perkinson, and Lee Allen and I. Old Perk worked for the highway department, and Lee Allen worked for Judge Couch. And I went to Judge Couch and said, "Judge, we want you to sit down and talk with Estes Keepoff." He said, "Why, you couldn't even get him to Chattanooga." He said, "I'm just getting tired of him." And we pled with Mr. Wiley until he said, "Well, if you'll have him in the Reed House next Saturday morning at such and such a time, I'll talk to him." And we got on the phone and told Estes that it was imperative that he had to come. We told him the whole story, and he'd already heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he came. And we, Mr. Couch and Lee stayed in the room, and Perk and I went to the airport and got Estes. And we put them in the room together, and Judge Cass said, "You guys get out of here." And they had it for about 2 hours. And then we were sitting down in the lobby when it came out. And we said, "Well, is everything all right?" And Judge Cass said, "Well, I'm not going to let Frank Darwin run against him, but I'm going to give him some opposition." And he got Pup McWhirter.
What we want to do is make sure this works, George, and then...
In 5 minutes, this kind old lady and her son were in my office. The door was open and they were shown in. And she told me this story, that her son had been a soldier in Korea and that he had been notified as to when he would be discharged, and in his excitement that night they went to the PX and had a beer party, and everybody got drunk, and this boy got hit in the head with a beer bottle, and they told him that they'd have to take him to the dispensary. And when he got to the dispensary, he told the doctor, said, "Doctor, I've only got a small cut on my head, and just put a stitch or two in it and it won't delay my going home." And for some reason or other, that's what the man in the dispensary did. But when he got home, according to his mother, and her name was Smith, she said that since he'd been home that he had spells where his head hurt and that he sometimes went out of his head. Now, she was smart enough to go to the VA's office, and they found all of his credentials, and it showed on there that he had been cut slightly in the head, but it wasn't serious and was just sewn up. And because of that, no more serious than it was, they would not admit him to the Veterans Hospital. And she says, I understand that you know Senator Kefauver. She didn't pronounce his name right, but I knew who she was talking about. And I said, yes. And she gave me the facts about her son, his record in the service and his number and all this, that, and the other. And I called Kefauver, and I didn't talk to Kefauver, but I talked either to Lucille Myers or to Miss Henrietta O'Donohue, who were chief people in Kefauver's organization, and I gave them the facts. And the next day, I received a wire from Kefauver telling me that he had notified the veteran head office in Nashville to admit that boy and to send him a wire as to when he was being admitted. About three days later, I got a copy of the wire that had gone to Kefauver. And the boy had already been into the hospital. But I never heard a word from him after that time. I think that his mother just didn't realize that it was proper to notify me. Mm-hmm. But long after I left public office and was in the real estate business, I was crossing Cherry Street one day going into Home Plate to eat lunch. And a fine, white-headed boy, he was white-headed when I first saw him, but I didn't recognize him this time, approached me and he said, are you Commissioner McIntyre? I said, I used to be. He said, don't you know me? I said, no. And then he told me about having come into my office with his mother. And then it was perfectly clear to me. I said, how are you getting along? He said, they operated on me and found a tumor growing next to my brain. And that was what was causing me to come and go. Mm-hmm. And to lose control of myself. But he said, they corrected it. And I said, well, how are you getting along? He said, I'm doing fine. He said, I've got a bulldozer with a front end loader and a big truck and a young man that helps me. And said, I keep busy. And he said, I want to thank you. That was all it needed. Now, I always have to turn back to Kefauver. During one of my elections, I've forgotten which one, but I'd mentioned the fact that some of the black people were against me. And I notified Estes to that effect. And he wrote two or three letters to various leaders in Chattanooga. And then he wrote me a letter and said, George, you know I'm busy in this crime investigation. He said, I don't know where I'll be when the election is over. But when it's over, and results are in, I want you to call me. And at that time, Estes was in New York trying Frank Costello and some woman named Hill.
That's right. Virginia Hill and Frank Costello were underworld figures, and with his committee on television, he was investigating to see whether they had committed any crimes. It would require new federal laws by congressional power. Very noted case at that time, George.
Well, now, that night, The complete returns of the election had not come in until right after 12 o'clock. And I went to a telephone in the courthouse where the election returns came in. And I asked the local operator to put me in touch with an operator in New York City, which she did. And in the kindest southern drawl that I could come forth with, I said to that lady, I want to speak to Senator Estes Kefauver. She says, well, where do I reach him? I said, well, he's staying in one of your leading hotels. And she says, mister, do you realize how many leading hotels there are in New York? I said, yes, but you ought to know that I'm talking about this man who is up there trying Frank Costello and this Hill woman on this crime investigation. He's the head of it. And she said, what did you say his name was? I said, Kefauver. And she pronounced his name entirely different from what I had.
Mm-hmm.
She says, is this important that you get him? I said, yes. She says, well, if that's who you're talking about, I can find out through the press or somebody as to where he's staying.
Mm-hmm.
And in about 5 minutes, the phone rang, and Esther answered the phone.
Well, I'll be there.
And I told him, I said, big stuff, we beat him. And he said, well, George, I sure am glad. But I thought after that, after we hung up, that Estes was sort of sorry that he told me to get in touch with him, didn't matter where he was, but I followed his instructions. On another occasion, I was in Houston, Texas, attending a national convention of the American Municipal League at the Shamrock Hotel. And on that day that I got out there, Estes Kefauver died.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to try to make a connection that would put me in Knoxville in time for the funeral, which they said was the next day. And I couldn't. And then I picked up the noonday paper, and it said that Vice President Johnson is arriving in town this afternoon to speak to the American Municipal Association at lunching tomorrow. But because of the sudden death of Senator Estes Kefauver, instead of speaking at lunch, he's going to speak at breakfast. And I read, and it gave an account of the people who had come to Houston with the vice president, one of whom was a young man that I had met when Carter, named Carter, who was an administrative assistant to Johnson when he was in the Senate. And they were not staying at the same hotel, but I called this hotel where they were staying, and I got in touch with this fellow Carter. And after a while, he said he remembered me as being a friend of Estes Kefauver. And I asked him if there was any way that I could go to Madisonville with Vice President Johnson. He said, well, all I can do, said the president's taking a nap now. He always takes a nap in the afternoon, your vice president. Said, I will tell him who you are and what you want to do. He said, now in the morning at breakfast when he's speaking, you get as close to the stage to him as you can. And as soon as he finishes speaking, rush up to him and tell him who you are. Have your badge on. I said, Carter, I'm not going to rush up to a vice president. Somebody will have to shoot me. He said, no, I'll tell them to that if you got a card on named McIntyre to permit you to talk to the vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a big fella, as you remember, and he put his arm around my shoulder. He said, George, said, I'm flying in a nine-place plane, and I'm going to Madisonville in the morning. But Lady Bird wants to go with me, and I don't have a place for you. He said, now, if you want me to tell Nancy something for you, said, I'll go kiss her on the cheek and tell her. Well, after that time, Kennedy was killed and Johnson became president, and then he came through Chattanooga campaigning. And I, being on the commission, along with all the other public officials, were invited to be in the reception line with our name tag on. And the president got off the plane and Hub Walters was with him and Ellington was with him and Clement was with him and Joe Evans was with him. But Johnson, all he had done all the way down the line with the people was just shake hands and keep walking. And he saw my name and he winked at me. And he got up to me and he stopped, and at that minute, George Hull made a picture of him shaking hands with me. He later came and asked me why the president had stopped to speak to me. I didn't tell him, but here's what President Johnson said. He said, McIntyre, are you still mad at me? I said, Mr. President, well, I couldn't get mad at you. He said, well, you wanted me to take you to Madisonville, and I couldn't take you. But he said, I kissed Nancy on the cheek and told her what you said.
And then I
went ahead. Now, I've got just one other story to tell you. And it's, I depended on Keith Offer for everything in Washington. Mm-hmm. Our congressman was Brock, I believe. Well, didn't he?
Didn't who?
Our congressman had been J.B. Frazier.
Yeah.
Up until Estes went to the Senate.
That's right.
And then we got a Republican up there, didn't we, Bill Brock?
That's right.
Well, nevertheless, I walked into Estes's office late one afternoon.
This is when he was senator?
When he was senator.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, George, I've just sent a bunch of Tennesseans to the White House to see the president. Do you want to go? I said, well, sure. He said, well, I'll have to make some sort of extra arrangements to get you in. And he called and got the gate, the little
guardhouse
right inside the gate on the right as you go in.
Mm-hmm.
And he had told this man who he was. And Chief Offer, as I've said so many times, he was very well respected and could do most anything in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And he told him, I've got another Tennessean I want to come down and go through the line. And he said, George, run out there and catch you a cab. And when I got down there, I started in, and the first guard stopped me and said, what are you doing in here? I said, Senator Kiefhofer sent me down here. And there was a man inside the little White House that walked out. And he said to his fellow guard, he said, what is this? He said, here's a man that says that Senator Kiefhofer has sent him down here. And he began to look at me, and he said, well, you've got on such and such color a suit, and it's a striped tie like Estes Kiefhofer said it was. And he said you would be wearing a Lions Club pin. And for me to admit you. And said, you go ahead. I walked into that office, and the first thing I saw was that picture where, that cartoon where Truman was holding up the press where they said that Dewey had been elected. But the Tennessee line, the Tennessee group, had just left the press. And the man at the door said to me, said, McIntyre, you go in, and when you get in front of the president's desk, reach across the desk, tell him your name and where you're from, and shake hands with him, and keep going, because he's a busy man. And I got in front of his desk, about like I am you, and he didn't have a great big desk. And I reached over and I said, Mr. President, my name's George McIntyre.